Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, March 6th. It's almost spring. We're getting there. My name is Magus Stiefeld. I'm your host for this hour, and we have some great stuff coming up for you. We're going to start the show with our series, What's Up in Burnaby, talking to Srishti Gangdev of the Burnaby Beacon about some interesting stories from our local community here in Burnaby. A little later in the show, we have a part of a bit of a series we're running in March called Rendezvous de la Francophonie. It's part of a series of interviews produced with the program Rendezvous de la Francophonie, which celebrates Canada's participation and partnership with the World Francophonie, or the community of people and nations speaking French. So we're going to be talking with Alex Friedman, who's the executive director of the Canadian Radio Foundation of Canada, and I'll talk a bit more about that, plus some great music and so many other interesting things this hour. But first, let's talk about what's up in Burnaby this week. Joining me today is Srishti Gangdev of the Burnaby Beacon. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to see you again this week. So let's get right into it. A story we've been following for a few weeks now continues to make the news. The waste treatment facility that has been proposed for 21 acres of Fraser Foreshore Park has been stirring up opposition, and Burnaby Council has noticed.
Yeah.
They're planning to, well, I don't know if you can call it survey the public. Tell me about what they're doing.
Yeah, so basically whenever city councils across BC want to do something like undedicate parkland, they have to go through by law what's called an alternative approval process. So that has actually opened now for the city of Burnaby. And it, rather than being like a vote for or against, what it does is it just registers opposition to the project. So if you oppose, you have to participate in the project. In the process, I should say. And if you're in favor of the project, you don't have to do anything at all. And if there's fewer than 10% of the electorate who opposes the project, then City Council can go ahead with undedicating that parkland and turning it into the organic waste facility that we've been talking about. There is quite a lot of vocal opposition to the project that, you know, we've heard, that our friends at Burnaby Now have heard, that City Council has heard. But it's going to be interesting to see whether that translates into people taking part in this democratic process.
It does seem like an odd sort of way to do it, to only test one side of the question. For starters, yeah. That seems a little odd. And then it seems like, I mean, the 10% threshold seems high. And then there's a lot of steps you need to take. Tell us about that, because it's not just like jump on the website and let them know or make a phone call. It's more involved.
Yeah, it for sure. It takes a lot of work, I would say, on the part of citizens to register their opposition to this project, which has, you know, garnered its own set of criticism. So to oppose the project, what you have to do is you have to go to the city website, you have to find an electoral response form, I believe it's called. You have to download it, print it out, sign it, and then actually mail it back or return it in person. And, you know, when you're maybe working in City Hall or you're on City Council, that seems like it makes sense. But I think for members of the public, that's a pretty arduous process. Mm-hmm. City Councilor Allison Gu mentioned in last week's council meeting, she herself doesn't actually own a printer. I don't own a printer. I don't know if you own a printer. But I think it's when you ask someone, like, do you oppose this project? It's easy for them to say, yeah, I do. And then for them to take that step and actually put pen to paper and go to a mailbox, it's a little tougher.
And of course, you know, the people who are going to be most concerned, most, you know, prone to opposing this project are going to be the people who live in that neighborhood, live nearby. You know, somebody who lives in the opposite corner of Burnaby might be, oh, well, that's, I don't like this idea, but I'm not that motivated. So you're really talking, you know, I mean, to get a 10% of Burnaby voter population, you're going to look at a much higher percentage of the people who genuinely feel affected by this potential project.
I kind of disagree.
Okay.
You know, Fraser Foreshore Park is in kind of an industrial area, so a lot of the residences are up by Big Bend, so not necessarily in walking distance or anything. Right. And it is a pretty beloved park, I'd say. So we've been hearing, like, in our inbox at the Burnaby Beacon, we've been hearing opposition from people who live all over Burnaby and outside Burnaby as well.
Right.
Not to say that there aren't people who support it, because we've been hearing from them too, but I will say that the most vocal opinions on this have been opposing.
So will there be other public processes coming up as part of this decision-making process? Is there going to be any public meetings or the kind of things you usually get with, you know, bylaw changes and zoning changes and new development approvals? Any of that kind of thing? Is any of that going to be happening?
No, this is the last step in the process. So residents have until, I believe the date is April 28th, to participate in this process if they are opposed. There was some discussion at the last council meeting about whether there needs to be more outreach and education on, you know, letting people know that this is actually happening. And it was a pretty interesting discussion, just to hear councillors say that they thought there had been enough outreach, and that, you know, I'll say that, you know, one of the councillors said that he thinks members of the public are pretty well informed on what councils do. And yeah, I'll disagree with that on the record. I think that the average resident has absolutely no clue what's going on in their city hall, what their council is doing. So I think it's, you know, you have to talk to people on the street in order to find out how engaged they really are in municipal politics. Right. And they're not.
Well, I think, you know, our common voter turnout for municipal elections reinforces that view.
We had an absolutely abysmal turnout in the last election, and that's a full municipal election where people are choosing their mayor, their city council, their school trustees, and less than 20% of the entire population of Burnaby came out to vote. So in this case, they're asking people to do a lot of work on a particular project, and they need, like, the level of the threshold that they would need to turn this project around is 10%.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty far-fetched, but let's see, maybe the people of Burnaby will surprise me.
Yeah. Are community groups organizing around this?
I'm sure they are. There's been already some, you know, petitions and letter campaigns to city council. And the feedback that we've received in our inboxes so far is that, you know, people, groups of people, at least certain people, do want this project to stop. Yeah. So I'm sure that they are working on campaigns to get people sending these forms in.
Yeah, I've definitely seen it coming up on social media. So I guess we'll be talking about this again in future weeks, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Another thing Burnaby Council is doing is taking steps to make amends to its Chinese Canadian citizens, past and present, for discriminatory policies and bylaws that have been enacted by past councils going back 100 years. A really interesting article, kind of a hidden history of Burnaby. Tell me a bit about, what council is planning to do.
Yeah, so the city is going to be launching a full review process, basically, with members of the Chinese Canadian community, just kind of starting a dialogue with them on what they would like to see in terms of a reconciliation for some of these past actions. And it will, you know, council has already said this is going to lead to a formal apology. And I think it's really important to note that in Canada, when we talk about anti-Asian discrimination historically, we're talking a lot about the federal and provincial laws, like the head tax and the Chinese Exclusion Act and things like that, which are hugely important topics. But, you know, we in that conversation tend to forget that there were real deliberate and specific actions taken by city councils, including in Burnaby. Stuff like, you know, council unanimously endorsed in the 1920s that they would give preference to companies that were only hiring white employees. For a time, Chinese people were not allowed to work for the municipality at all, whether that was directly employed by the city of Burnaby or through contractors. There were specific targeted actions of enforcement towards Chinese and Asian-owned businesses. And even if they didn't specifically mention any ethnicities, they were, I think what the report called them was facially neutral. So, you know, really ambiguous language in the writing of these policies and bylaws, but extremely targetable towards Chinese and Asian communities.
And, you know, when I was reading about some of the examples, it really makes you wonder, this is the stuff that's enacted in policies. And imagine what that kind of, the atmosphere that created when a Chinese person went to City Hall or to others to get services. You know, the, you know, you can imagine that when the government and the city itself is putting out these discriminatory policies that, you know, the frontline workers probably would have felt quite comfortable not providing good service or, you know, I mean, it extends into a whole bunch of other things that Chinese Canadians were going to be facing, just in the routine and on the daily that, would have been fully endorsed by, well, in this case, three levels of government to say, well, if you're a Chinese citizen, I don't need to, you know, treat you with respect and give you good service from the city of Burnaby. It's, you can imagine how that played out, at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. It was kind of like a default segregation almost of services. And I'm hesitant to use the word segregation because it connotes like a very specific, you know, yep, system that existed in the United States and here for a while. But it was, you know, a de facto system where if you were a visible minority, you were not living the same kind of life in this city and in this country.
I think it's also one of the examples that's in your article is about a policy that was, and this was sort of made my eyes pop a little when I read it, you know, suggested by the Vancouver branch of the Ku Klux Klan, and then was endorsed by Burnaby City Council back in the day. I think it was in the 1920s, you know, with only two members opposing. And that's also a good reminder to all of us that, you know, even organizations as odious as that were active here in BC and able to get the ear of government.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of, in this day and age, it's kind of shocking to see something like that. But, you know, in the mid-20s, the Ku Klux Klan was like a social group in Vancouver, which is very scary to think about. But that's the social context in which we're talking about. And one thing I thought was interesting as well was the city made an application to the province to allow municipalities to deny retail and wholesale trading licenses to certain ethnicities. And the province, a hugely racist organization, said that was too far a step and denied the bid. So that was something that I thought was really interesting.
Wow. So how long is this process going to take?
It's going to take a couple months or a few months, I should say. I'm just trying to remember the timeline here, but I don't think I have it directly at hand. But it's going to involve kind of an advisory board being put together with members of the community, people from the city, people from, you know, different institutions. And they're going to kind of go through some of these examples. And, you know, this is just the very top layer of what exactly happened. So it's going to go, you know, delve a little further and figure out a course of action that will constitute something like reconciliation.
Right. And will there be a public ceremony at the end? Has that been articulated yet?
With formal apologies, there usually are. Again, we don't have a timeline for that, but I would expect that it would be sometime, you know, in the future.
Right. Okay, well, we'll keep an eye out for that. Maybe moving on to a bit of a lighter topic now, let's talk about beer and tacos. So a popular cafe is launching a new
beer on this show. I'm personally really excited because I love me some tacos. And like we've talked about, I love a good pint of beer as well. But, you know, we like highlighting these local businesses every now and then at the Beacon. And there's a Mexican restaurant in town called Olivo Cafe and Eatery, actually down by Big Bend, that is launching a taco truck, which is really exciting news. So Tacosaurus is had its debut on Friday, and you'll find them at breweries kind of around town. I know they've got maybe a weekly setup at Studio Brewing and at Steamworks Tap Room as well for the next couple of weeks. So yeah, really exciting stuff.
Great. Fun stuff. It's always fun to check out a new food truck with a nice pint of beer.
That's right.
All right. Thanks so much for joining me this week, Shristi.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Just want to do a quick shout out. As always, to Burnaby Beacon. You know, if you're looking for more stories like this, whether it's municipal politics or events or food trucks and stuff like that, please give us a subscribe at burnabybeacon.com, and you'll get all this information in your inbox every morning.
Great, Shristi Gangdev, reporter with the Burnaby Beacon. And that's what's up in Burnaby this week. We will be back next week with some more interesting stories. Thanks for joining me today, Shristi.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Okay, talk to you soon. Bye. And thanks to Shristi Gangdev of the Burnaby Beacon. What's up, Burnaby? We'll be back next Monday, just after around 10 after 10 o'clock. And you can find out what are the big stories happening in Burnaby. We got some great music for you here. This is a new release from Sean Kuti and Black Thought. The album is called African Dreams, and this is the title track.
Are you a committed person to black people?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I believe that the liberation and salvation of the black nation must be brought about by black people gaining a thorough knowledge of self.
Listen, I dream prayers, friendly do-eyes, lines from Henry Dumas, and cautionary tales witnessed with my own two eyes. A few guys can serve two gods, the difference is a subtle nuance. With oxymorons, believing true lies, I contend. My pens to the pages again, thoughts procreate, negotiate the wages of sin. I'm such a standout performer, I'm unable to blend. They gave me a seat and my power caused the table to spin. I'm the reflection in the glass, the shadows in the grass, the arrow with the wings of a sparrow in its path. I'm as mad. Majesty of Pharaoh, some will never know the half. They'll forever know the wrath of my paragraph. When the ink blinking, some thinking something evil coming out. Unreasonable doubt. What's a feasible amount of sacrifice if I'm already unachievably devout? With a contribution that's too inconceivable to count.
Too many want that good life.
But black people are a people of rhythm and spirit, so I also give
food. Where I go day to day, if Nkrumah no dream for me. Where we go day to day, if Sankara no dream for we. Fumi Layo, my Arimba, I need them dream. Where I go day to day, if Govara no dream for me. So I dey carrying on the mission, carrying on the dream, carrying on the torch. For a long time, we dey feel this pain, we dey feel this hurt. I said their blood keep calling me, giving me this warrior
sacrifice and dedication. African revolution.
So many want that good life.
When a bird takes wing, it leaves most of us other creatures earthbound. Birds have evolved not only wings, but many other adaptations that make it possible to fly. First of all, feathers. Feathers provide insulation, waterproofing, and a means to fly. And they're extraordinarily lightweight. Other features also help minimize the pull of gravity, mostly by reducing body weight. Birds have very light, honeycombed, or hollow bones. And instead of a weighty mouthful of jawbones and teeth, birds have evolved a supremely light and serviceable beak. What birds eat also helps them stay light for flight. Most consume energy-packed foods rich in calories, like seeds, fruits, and meat. These are foods that add as little as possible to a bird's payload, and deliver a lot of bang for the buck. And what birds eat is processed rapidly, so they aren't weighed down by waste. All of these adaptations for flight. And a pair of wings, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day. And you can get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram, at Bird Note Radio.
Just before Bird Note there, we heard from Sean Kuti and Black Thought, African Dreams, from the album of the same name, just recently released in the last couple months. You can find it on all the major streaming services or right here on CJSF. We got another track for you coming up. This is Non-Status, an Indigenous band from Canada. And this is the title track from a recent EP that came out just at the beginning of January called January 3rd.
Thank you.
January 3rd from Status Non Status. Status Non Status used to be known as Whoop Zoo, a band that had a lot of releases out over the years, many of them doing very well on campus stations like ours across Canada. It's led by Anishinaabe Canadian singer-songwriter Adam Sturgeon, and they had a full-length album out last spring, I think it was. This track here we just heard was from an EP which came out at the beginning of this year. All right, on to our next segment. This is from a series of interviews that happens each year called Rendezvous de la Francophonie. And it is, we're going to be playing a few of these over the next couple weeks or so. As part of an annual celebration of Canada's membership in the Francophonie that promotes the French language and its numerous cultural expressions. And it runs from, well, this weekend through to the 24th of March. We have six of these segments that we're going to be using. So I think you'll probably hear from another one on this program next Monday. I'm not sure where all the others will be landing on our schedule. But it's going to be six interviews hosted by Campus Community Radio broadcaster Catherine Fisher, who's from our sister station CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. She's also been a long time member of the campus community. and it's part of when I say celebrating the Francophonie, that's not just the language, but it's actually an international organization of which Canada is a member, with 57 member states at the last count I saw anyway, around the world, where French is either the primary language or a significant secondary language, as is the